You know, I've said it before and I'm going to say it again. The main message of Conversations with God is really contained in the first three lessons that were brought in the dialogue itself. And those first three messages are found in actually book one of the nine books of the Conversations with God series. Please forgive me if I'm repeating myself, but I found that sometimes saying the same thing two or three times can help everyone really grasp and get a good handle on what it is that I'm trying to communicate. So let me tell you once again, the first three of the many, many extraordinary messages in Conversations with God are, I think, the three most important. And here they are, once again. Message number one, we are all one. Message number two, there's enough. And now message number three, there's nothing we have to do. This is the most unusual, I think, of the first three messages. And although all three of those messages are contradicted and have been contradicted by our teaching, what we've been told, what we've been taught by our society, by our common culture, this one, this third message, there's nothing we have to do, is the most contradicted, I think. It's the one that we have the most evidence to prove, oh, really? Really? You don't think there's anything we have to do? Because everything in our society tells us otherwise. The laws of our land, in every country of the world, tells us what we have to do, and of course what we cannot do, which is the other side of it. So, but it goes beyond that. It goes beyond simply the laws of our land that tell us what we have to do. We have an understanding of God, those of us who believe in God. And that's, by the way, billions of the world's people, as I've mentioned before. The billions of people in the world who believe that there is a higher power that we call God, Yahweh, Brahman, Jehovah, whatever, they believe that God says there is something we have to do. There are certain requirements, certain things you must do if you want to stay in God's good graces. If you want to go back to heaven, back to paradise, back to God, when you die. So we have two levels, really, of stuff that we think we have to do. Maybe even three levels, if I could define it in this way. The three levels are what our common culture or our society tells us we have to do. And that includes our family traditions, and so forth. Many things that are just familial in nature, that are reduced down to our family demands, if you please, and our family customs and cultures. Then the second level is our legal system, the things that our laws tell us we have to do. We stop at a red light. And some of these things are, by the way, common all over the world. Red lights being a perfect example. I don't care what world, what country of the world you're visiting, it's the same all over the world. We've agreed that red light means stop and green light means go, and that's true in every country of the world. There's no disagreement about all of that. So we have the legal system that we depend on to tell us what it is we have to do, and as I said, what we cannot do. And then finally, the third level is the level of divinity. For those people who believe that there is such a thing called God, that there are God's requirements as well. So three levels at least, maybe more if we look at it more closely, but at least three levels at which we experience that there are things we have to do. So when I come along speaking on behalf of the messages and conversations with God and say, there's nothing you have to do, you know, my audiences tell me around the world, oh, right, really, yes, of course. See, because they don't believe that. Because once again, the evidence of our eyes, the evidence of our experience on the earth tells us that exactly the opposite is true. Especially with regard to the larger issue of what we are supposedly required to do to stay in God's good graces. And that's what I want to talk about here in this particular lesson. Because this lesson and the whole series of lessons that I've created here for you revolves around the notion that God exists. that there is such a thing called God, a higher power, an unmoved mover, whatever word you want to use, that there is this larger being or essence in the universe. And I teach from that place, because if that's not true, if there really is no such thing as God, if there is no larger essence, then most of what I'm saying here has no application in your life. Maybe there are some fundamental practical applications, but most of the applications that I'm talking about are dealing with how we interact with the God of our understanding. Now, the God of my understanding tells us there's nothing that you have to do. There are things that you will do, but nothing you have to do. And there's a huge difference between what you will do and what you choose to do and what you have to do. By the way, let me just get back to real life on earth, the legal system in the world, or even the social customs of our families and our cultures. Even in that sense, there's nothing you have to do. That is, nothing you're required to do if you don't care about the outcome. The only reason that you have to do something is because you care about the outcome. That is, if you don't do a certain thing, other things may occur that you don't agree with. If you don't stop at a red light, to give you a simple example, if you don't stop at the red light, you could get killed, or you could kill somebody else. And you don't want to do either one of those things, I'm sure. So you stop at a red light, but not because you have to. That is, not because you're required to, but because you choose to. And you choose to because it serves your own highest, best interest. It's important to understand that. It's important to understand that nobody does anything they don't want to do. Let me repeat that, because you may not have heard that. I mean, it may have slipped in one ear and out the other, you know how they say? So let me repeat that. I said, nobody does anything they don't want to do. Now, if that's true, then there's nothing we have to do, and just a whole bunch of things that we choose to do because we desire a certain outcome. For instance, we don't want to go to jail. So we do things that we think that we have to do, but we're only doing them because we don't want to go to jail. We don't want to break the law. Many people go ahead and break the law anyway. They don't pay their taxes, or they find some other way to break the law, hoping they can get away with it. And of course, as we know, many people do get away with it. They actually get away with it. They make a life of getting away with it. So they've demonstrated actually to us that there's nothing you really have to do. Which brings up an interesting question, by the way. What would you do if you thought you could get away with doing anything you wanted to do? That's an interesting human question. What would you do if you felt that you could get away with anything that you wanted to do? We're going to talk about that in just a little bit, but first of all, let's get back to this whole God idea. Why would God require of us or demand of us that we do certain things? Why would God do that? Why do you think? See, religion, most of the world's organized religions, want to have it both ways. They want to have it both ways. They want us to believe that God is the all in all, the highest and grandest, the biggest expression of life there is, that which needs nothing to be happy. And so if God needs nothing to be happy, if God is everything that God could possibly need, you know, and God is, by the way. If you believe in God at all, surely you must believe that God is everything that God could possibly need. And I don't mean just physical stuff. I mean even emotional experiences. God is the highest happiness. God is the grandest joy. God is the greatest wisdom. God is the most compassion. God is the most unconditionally loving. God is those things. So if God is every emotional experience that God could possibly have, and if God actually imbues itself, if divinity and the energy of divinity is found in every physical thing as well, what could God possibly need? The answer is, of course, nothing. God needs nothing, or God wouldn't be God. But because God is God, God needs nothing. But now, if God needs nothing, why would God require? Why would God require anything if God needs nothing? That's the key question. And it's difficult for religions to explain that to us. Some of the religions say, well, you know, because it's about justice. You know, and some religions tell us it's about purity. To give you an example, some religions tell us that God doesn't require anything, but God doesn't want anything messy or dirty around him. So in order for you to get back into heaven, you got to come back spotless, because you left spotless. When you were born, you were spotless. Except some religions teach even that's not true. Some religions actually teach us that we weren't even born without sin. We were born in sin. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine a religion that teaches us that at the moment of our birth, in the 1 second after we were born, we were already guilty? Some churches call that original sin. That we carry the sins of our fathers and of our forefathers and our forebears and our family before us. And way back until the beginning of the human race, one presumes. Adam and Eve, you know, the mythology of Adam and Eve. That because Adam and Eve apparently sinned, the sins of Adam and Eve have been created a stain. They've branded all the rest of us through all the eons of time, through all the generations from the first human beings till today. We still have to pay for the sins of Adam and Eve. Now, I know that might sound a little bit strange, if not, forgive me for using the word, if not simply ridiculous. It might sound ridiculous to some people. But do you know that there are some entire religions that are based on that understanding? That we are born impure, and our job is to somehow get back to God, even though God doesn't want any impurity around it. So the notion, the theological notion, goes like this. God is that which is perfect, and therefore nothing which is imperfect can exist in the kingdom of heaven. So in order to get back into the kingdom of heaven, you have to be perfect. Well, but you can't be perfect because you were born imperfect to begin with. Plus the fact that probably you've misbehaved, so to speak. You've violated some of God's laws. Oh yes, I forgot to tell you that God has rules. You know, laws. Commandments, if you will. There are supposedly 10 of them. And that's just one particular brand of religion. There are other religions as well that have their ideas about what God, what the Supreme Being, what the all in all requires and demands of us. And it requires and demands these things of us so that we can remain as perfect as possible. Because if we violate those laws, then we will have committed an offense against God, and those offenses pile up. We get a big pile of them, big stack of them, called our sins, and then we're really in trouble. We've got to find a way to get God to forgive us our sins so that we can get back into heaven, because there are these things that we have to do. Now, what happens to the world's religions? What happens to the world's great theologies if the idea that there's something we have to do is taken off the table? Now what happens? The whole belief system falls apart. The whole idea that God will punish us if we don't do the things that we are required to do falls apart. Excuse me. If in fact there's nothing we're required to do. What an interesting idea. What would it be like if we felt there was nothing we are required to do, and only things that we can choose to do if we wish to produce a certain outcome. But now let me ask you another question. If God requires us to do nothing, what would be the new moral code? That is, what would be our motivation for doing anything or for not doing anything? If I understand on earth, if you don't stop at the red light, you could hurt yourself. You could hurt somebody else. You could be in deep trouble if you don't pay your taxes, if you don't obey the laws. You could go to jail. You know, but okay, at least I see, you know, the cause and effect relationship. But if we don't believe in a God who punishes us, if we don't believe that God is like human beings, that has laws that have to be obeyed, and if we don't obey those laws, we're punished by God with everlasting damnation, by the way, not just with a few years in jail or a small amount of time that we're paying a penalty. See, God doesn't dabble in limited penalties. God says, you know what? If you go to hell, you're there for all eternity, for the rest of all time. So what happens if we take that off the table? Then what reason would there be for us to behave or to not behave in a certain way? Because we have not come up yet with that particular reason because we have not come up with that new moral code, religions have kept their ideas in place about God and about what God requires us to do. If you take that off the table, the fear is that humanity would run amok, that we would go crazy, that we would disobey all the rules that life would have us obey because we have no reason not to. How would you be as a human being if you could get away with anything at all? What reason would there be to be nice, to be compassionate, to be forgiving, to be caring, to be gentle with each other, to be fair, to treat each other fairly? What reason would there be? Conversations with God answers that question. It gives us a new moral code, a wonderful new direction for all of us. That doesn't require us to believe in or to accept the notion that a higher power is going to get us. Going to get us if we don't behave, if we're not good. But if that's not the case, then what's the new moral code? And conversations with God tells us that the new moral code is really as ancient as time itself. It's not really new at all. It's an old moral code, but newly applied as a theological understanding, as a theological construction. So here it is. Here's the new reason to do or not do anything. And by the way, the irony of it is that it's the same reason in relationship to our understanding of God as it is in relationship to our understanding of our family, our society, our culture, and our legal system. It's the same reason for everything. And here's that reason. Here's that moral code. What works? It's a matter of what works. Either a particular behavior works or it doesn't work, given what it is you're trying to do. I'll give you a simple example. Most of you know what this is. It's a cell phone. But in order for me to use it, in order for it to work, I can't put it in my mouth. What doesn't work? It only works if I put it up to my ear. That's what makes me put it to my ear, because this is what works. This doesn't work. It's really very simple. I'm not putting it to my ear because I'm required to, because God says you have to. I do it because that's how it works. It's really very simple. But what works and what does not work is defined, that is, we decide what works and what does not work, based on what it is we're trying to do. If I'm trying to make a telephone call, this works. But if I'm trying to eat the telephone and get a taste of the telephone, this doesn't work. This works. This is what works if I want to actually eat the phone, or at least decide what it tastes like. I can't decide what the phone tastes like this. I can only decide that way, right there. So it depends on what it is you're trying to do. Listen, maybe you think I'm being a little silly right now, but I'm making a very important point. Listen carefully. Every decision you make in life is made based on your assessment of what it is that works, depending on what it is you're trying to do. Now, here's the problem. The problem faced by humanity as a collective and by human beings individually. The problem is really quite simple. Most people don't know what they're trying to do. This is especially true in our relationship with God. We do understand what we're trying to do for the most part here on earth. Excuse me. We do understand what we're trying to do most of the days and times that we're on the planet. We understand what we're trying to do. Trying to be happy, trying to live a good life, trying to experience joy and love, and all the wonderful aspects of our time here on this planet. That's what we're trying to do. But it's amazing how many people are not clear or have an inaccurate notion of what we're trying to do in relationship to the thing we call God. Most people don't know what we're trying to do. And here's what's interesting beyond that. Even people who think they know what they're trying to do on the earth are wrong about that. That is, their idea of why we're here, why are we on the earth, what am I trying to do here, is totally inaccurate because it's utterly incomplete. It tells only a small portion of the story. But let me share something with you, a piece of information that you might find interesting. When you know what it is you're trying to do, when you're very clear on what it is you're trying to accomplish, you don't need any laws. You don't need any requirements. You don't need any demands. You do what you need to do to accomplish what you're trying to accomplish, and you do it automatically. Automatically, without being required by anybody to do it. Let me give you a real life example. I'm going to give you an example from real life. Ever been to Paris? If you've ever been to Paris, go to a place called the Arc de Triomphe. It's at the very end of the Champs-Élysées. At the very end of it. The Champs-Élysées being one of the, if not the, busiest avenue, busiest boulevards in the city of Paris. And at the end of that boulevard, there's a circle, a traffic circle, around the Arc de Triomphe. It's a traffic circle that receives traffic from about 7 or 8 individual roads coming into it. Roads that come into the circle. That means that there are thousands of cars crossing that circle every day, hundreds every hour, dozens every moment of the day. You don't want to drive on the Arc de Triomphe if you've never driven in Paris before. My first time in a car was in the back seat of somebody who lived in Paris. And even that was scary. But you know what's interesting? With all those cars coming at us from every different angle, coming from the left, coming from the right, coming from the... There are no lane markings on the roadway around that circle. No lane markings. There are no traffic lights. There are no traffic signs. There's not a traffic policeman. There is no rule or regulation or guideline whatsoever. Nothing. The law is the law of survival. There's nobody telling you what to do. No guidelines of any kind on the road. No markings of any kind. But what's interesting, I call it, by the way, I call it suicide circle. This is called suicide circle around the Arc de Triomphe. But you know what's interesting? Everyone is trying to do the same thing. And they all know what they're trying to do. Everybody who goes on that traffic circle, who travels that traffic circle, understands, I'm trying to get to the other side. And I'm trying to do it and stay alive. And I'm trying to do it without hurting anybody else. So you have thousands of people all trying to do the same thing at the same time, and everyone knowing that what they're trying to do. Everyone knowing that everyone else is trying to do the same thing. The result of that is astonishing. Do you know that statistics show that there are fewer traffic accidents and far fewer traffic fatalities on the circle around the Arc de Triomphe than there are on the Champs-Élysées 500 yards away, where there are traffic cops, traffic policemen, lane markings, signs, lights, and everything? In other words, all the rules and regulations don't create the safety that is evident on the Arc de Triomphe, where there's not any regulation at all, because people are self-regulating when they all agree with themselves and with each other on what it is they're trying to do. Isn't that fascinating? You find that as fascinating as I do? Because when I was in Paris, I found that utterly fascinating. How people self-regulate out of simply knowing and agreeing on what it is we're trying to do. Now, on the planet at large, people have no idea what they're trying to do. They think they're trying to make a living, trying to get through life, trying to be happy, trying to find love, whatever they're... But they don't know. Most people have no idea what they're really doing here. And that's because they have no idea who they really are. Most people think that they're this body. I am this. Or maybe I'm my mind, or maybe I'm my body and my mind. But a small percentage of the world's people, the smallest percentage, understand that they are not their body and not their mind. You are not your body. You are that which has a body. You are not your mind. You are that which has a mind. You are an essence that exists apart and aside from your body and mind and exists eternally and is simply taken on a body and a mind, that is, embrace these essences of life, this body and this mind, as tools. Tools with which to accomplish what you really came here to do, which has nothing to do with what most people are doing on the planet. Trying to make a living, trying to be successful, trying to find love, trying to stay healthy. And these are nice things to do. These are nice ways of accomplishing what you came here to accomplish. But you didn't come here to accomplish these things. The reason that you are on the earth, what you came here to do, is to announce and to declare, to express and to fulfill, to become and to experience who you really are. Or to put it in simple language, you've come here for the experience of being divine. You've come here to experience yourself as God. You've come here to express your divinity, to know yourself experientially. That's what you're doing here. That's why you came to the earth. That's why you came to the planet. And if we all understood that, our behaviors would be self-regulating. That is, there would be certain things you wouldn't do, because a person who is expressing divinity simply wouldn't do that. You wouldn't talk a certain way. You wouldn't act a certain way. You wouldn't do certain things. Because a person who is expressing their highest notion of divinity would simply not behave, talk, or act in those ways. Every great spiritual master has evidenced this. Every great spiritual master has demonstrated what I've just said to you now, because they know why they're here, because they know who they are, And so at critical moments of their lives, they do what it is they came here to do. When you go to the Arc de Triomphe in your car, you know what you're trying to do. You're trying to get to the other side. We are also trying to get to the other side. We're also trying to complete the circle of life in a way that allows us to experience who we really are. And if we understand that and apply that wisdom and that understanding and that knowledge in the days and times of our life, we will discover that there's nothing we have to do, nothing we are required to do, but many things that we will do automatically, willingly, as a demonstration of our true identity. People who live that way change the world because they've changed themselves, because they've changed their whole lives, because they have a new reason, a new motivation to do anything at all. There's nothing that you have to do. There's nothing that we are required to do by anybody. But there are many things that we can willfully choose to do when we understand what we are seeking and attempting to accomplish. So there's a magic question that I invite you all to ask yourself when you confront any major decision in your life. From this day forward, there will be many major decisions. And by the way, I shouldn't even say major decisions. Let me rephrase that. There's a magic question you can ask yourself when you confront any decision, major, big decision, or tiny, small decision. A big decision like, who should I marry? Or should I even get married? Where should I work? What city should I live in? What should I do with the rest of my life? Or a small decision. Should we go out and have dinner tonight? What food shall we eat? What clothes shall we wear? What television programs will we watch this evening? What books will I read? What things will I say across the dinner table? The tiniest decisions as well. All of these choices and decisions can be contextualized in a brand new way by asking yourself what I call life's magic question. Here it comes, write it down. Write it down, here it comes, life's magic question. What does this have to do with the agenda of my soul? Did you get it? I'll say it again. What does this have to do with the agenda of my soul? As you sit down to have dinner, what does this have to do with the agenda of my soul? As you engage in a conversation with a loved one or a friend, what does this have to do with the agenda of my soul? As you turn on the television and decide which program to watch, what does this have to do with the agenda of my soul? You know what? When I go to the movie theater, my time in the theater is very limited. If I realize after I'm there 7 or 8 minutes that it has nothing to do with the agenda of my soul, I'm not interested in watching a movie that has nothing to do with the agenda of my soul. That might in fact be the exact opposite of the agenda of my soul, which is to demonstrate the highest notion I hold of what it means to be divine, what it means to express the divinity within me. That's the agenda of my soul. And if what I'm eating, what I'm reading, what I'm watching, what I'm experiencing, and what I'm doing does not support the agenda of my soul to demonstrate divinity, I want nothing to do with it. I have no time for irrelevant conversations, no time and no patience for any human activity that does not support the agenda of my soul. Am I successful 100% of the time in applying that particular yardstick, that particular measurement? Of course not. Am I more successful now than I was 25 years ago? You bet your life. Absolutely. Because now I know what I'm doing here and who I am. So, my dear friends, my message to you today is there's nothing you have to do. But there are some things that you will do and some things that you won't do, and you will behave automatically when you are clear what you're trying to accomplish. What am I doing on the earth? Why am I here? What is this really all about? These are life's major questions, and the answers are simple when you listen to your own conversation with God.